An Osho Talk. From Unconsciousness to Consciousness, number 19.
What is the difference between science, art, and religion?
Science discovers art, invents religion, does both. The true religion discovers, the pseudo religion invents, and down the ages it is the pseudo religion that has prevailed over human mind. It is nothing but fiction. It is closer to art, and absolutely against science. That's why there has been never a conflict between art and religion. They were deep down doing the same thing. Art was inventing objectively, and the so-called religion was inventing subjectively. They could join together very easily because their game was the same. And they joined hands all over the world. Art served the so-called religion for centuries. The beautiful churches, synagogues, temples, for thousands of years, art was doing nothing but serving religion. If you see the temples of Khajuraho in India, once there were 1,000 temples in that place. Now, only ruins are there, but 20 or 30 temples are still intact, survived. Just to see one temple, you will need the whole day. It is so full of art, every nook and corner. It must have taken hundreds of years for thousands of sculptors to make one temple. You cannot find a single inch space in the whole temple which has not been artistically created. One temple has thousands of statues. The outside of the temple, and that is the same about the remaining other 30, and the same must have been true about the ruins of 1,000 temples. Even in the ruins you can find treasures of art. I don't think there has ever been beauty created out of stone anywhere else in the world. The structure of every temple is almost similar. On the outer side of the temple, the outer wall, there are what are called mithun statues. Men and women naked, loving, making love. In all possible postures, one can imagine or dream the only posture that is missing is known in India as the missionary posture. Man on top of woman, only that is missing. So that was brought by Christian missionaries. Otherwise the whole idea to the Indian mind looked ugly, that the man should be on top of a woman seems to be unfair. The woman is more fragile. And this beast is on top of beauty. No, Indians have never thought of that posture as human. In India it is known as the missionary posture. Because for the first time they saw Christian missionaries in that posture. Otherwise they had no idea that this can be done. But except that, you will find all kinds of postures. Because in India, sexuology has existed at least for 5,000 years. The oldest sexual scripture is 5,000 years old. Vatasayanas, Kama Sutras, and in the time of Vatasayana, writing sutras on sex, Kama means sex, maxims for sex, guidelines for sex, was not thought to be an bad act, because Vatasayana is respected as one of the great seers of India. And it is said only a seer like Vatasayana could have given those beautiful sutras. They reveal the intricacies and the mysteries of the energy of sex and how it can be transformed. These temples in Khajuraho have on the outer side beautiful women, beautiful men, and all in love postures. Inside there are no love postures. Inside you will find the temple empty, not even a statue of a god. The idea is that unless you pass through your sexuality with full awareness in all its phases, in all its dimensions, unless you come to a point when sex has no meaning for you, only then you enter the temple. Otherwise, you are outside the temple. Your interest is there. So that was a symbol that if you are still interested in sex, then the temple is not for you. But the message is not against sex. It is the outer wall of the temple. The temple is made of it. And you have to pass through the door and go beyond. And the beyond is nothing but utter emptiness. How many artists, craftsmen, sculptures were implied to create 1,000 temples, a whole city of temples. How many years it took? And this is not only one place. There is Ajanta. A group of caves which Buddhists created. The whole mountain for miles they have carved caves inside the mountain. And inside the caves, you will find tremendous work of art. Everything is beautiful. Buddha's whole life in a stone. The first cave you enter and you find the birth of Buddha. And those are not small caves. At least 4 times bigger than this room, each cave. In solid stone they have been carved. And the whole life of Buddha slowly in each cave, and the last cave, Buddha is sleeping. The statue must be as long as this room. The last moment of his life, when he asked his disciples, if you have to ask any question, ask me. Otherwise, I am going into eternal sleep forever. He has not even a pillow, just his hand used as a pillow. But such a huge statue and so beautiful. There are Ellora caves again, carved in the mountains. There are Hindu temples in Jagannath Puri, in Konark. You cannot imagine for centuries what art has been doing. The beautiful cathedrals of Europe and all the great artists, Michelangelo, what these people were doing, they were serving religion. There was never a conflict anywhere in the world between religion and art. To me, that signifies that the religion was pseudo. Both were fictitious. There was no intrinsic opposition. They were moving in the same line of invention. Of course, the art was doing a far more authentic job, far more sincere than the priest, because what he was inventing was absolute fiction. There was no ground for it. His God was fiction, his hell and heaven was fiction. And these fictions have to be according to different people where the religion existed. For example, in Tibet, you can't have the same kind of heaven as in India. Obviously, India is a hot country, so hot that the heaven has to be air-conditioned. Of course, the word was not available at that time, but the description is absolutely of air-conditioning. It says 24 hours cool air, fresh spring. Fragrant. It is never summer. It is never rainy season. It is never cold winter. Just a cool, not cold, but a cool atmosphere all the year round. And it is always spring. But the Tibetan priest cannot accept it. They are so tortured by cold. Their heaven is warm, heated. It is never cold. They don't even mention cool, because to the people of Tibet, even cool is not acceptable. It has to be warm. In Tibetan scriptures, it says that you must take at least one bath per year. When Dalai Lama and his people started escaping from Tibet to India, many of them came to see me. Habits die hard. They were not taking baths or showers even in India. And they were using the same kind of clothes that they were using in Tibet. I had to tell them that I am very allergic to smells. So you sit to the other corner of the room. Unless you learn how to clean your body and change your clothes every day. They said, every day? But the religious scripture says once a year is enough. It is going to be different fiction in different countries. In Mohammedan countries, homosexuality was very much prevalent, is still prevalent. It's strange, but shows a significant fact about human mind. The greatest punishment also is for homosexual act. If you are found, just you have to be beheaded. There is no lesser punishment for it. Still, it is the most prevalent thing. so prevalent that in Quran the provision is made in heaven for the great religious sages. Beautiful women are available. Beautiful boys are also available. These are all fictions. Suiting to the particular mind, climate, country. Having no foundation in reality. Reality has not to be invented, it has to be discovered. It is already there. Hence, science discovers. And true religion also discovers. But up to now, the religion that has been in existence in the world, Christianity, Judaism, Mohammedanism, Hinduism, they never felt any conflict with art, but they all felt tremendous antagonism towards science. Nobody has noted the fact why they are not against art and why they are against science. Because with art they can find some similarity. They can use art, but they cannot use science. And they don't find the basic similarity. In fact, they find science is doing just the opposite. They are inventing. They are creating something imaginary. Science's whole work is to uncover the true, the real, that which is. Now, if science goes on succeeding, then the pseudo-religion becomes afraid. Because the fiction will not be able to stand in front of truth. There will be no possibility of its winning. Even standing before truth is impossible. I have loved the story very much. That one day, darkness approached God and said that I have never done any wrong to the sun, but it goes on torturing me. Wherever I go, it reaches, and I have to escape from there. I cannot even rest. I don't want to complain, but enough is enough. How long it is going to be? And I am absolutely innocent. I have not done anything against the sun. I have not said anything against the sun. This is for the first time I am talking about it. God immediately ordered the sun should be called. The sun is called. And God asks him, why you are torturing and bothering darkness? Son says, what you are talking about? I have never met anything called darkness. And God looked around where the darkness has gone. It had disappeared. The Son said, whenever you can manage darkness to bring in front of me, I am ready to ask apology or whatsoever you say. But I don't know. Perhaps without knowing, in an awareness, I may have heard. But at least let me see the person. Who is the person complaining against me? The story says that the file of the case against the Son by darkness is still lying there. God has not been able to bring together both the sides in front of him. Sometimes he succeeds, darkness comes, sometimes he succeeds, Son comes, but he has not been able to bring both together, and unless both are present, the case cannot be decided. How darkness come to face the Son? Because darkness has no existence. It is just absence of light. So where presence of light is, the absence cannot exist, cannot stand. And that is what pseudo-religion has been doing. Creating fictions, exploiting people, their imagination, their fear, their greed, their misery, their suffering, their poverty, everything. But the moment science started discovering things, every religion became very alert and ready to stop science in every possible way. Because if truth is revealed, the untruth dies by itself. There is no need to kill it. It simply disappears. Hence I say to you, that now is the time for the first religion to happen. For 300 years, the pseudo-religion have been fighting against science. Now, it is tired, fed up, and knows perfectly well that science is going to win. It has already won. So the old religions have lost their ground. You have to understand it. What you see in the churches and in the synagogues and in the mosques and the temples is the dead body of the religion that once was alive. It is only a corpse. But they are pretending that it is alive, hoping against hope that some miracle is going to happen. But no miracle ever happens. And no miracle is going to happen. Science has taken firm roots. Now, if you want in the world anything called to be religion, then you have to start from ABC, from the very scratch. A religion which is a science and not a fiction. Just as science discovers in the objective world, outside, religion discovers in the inner world. What science is to the objective existence, religion is to the subjectivity. Their methods are exactly the same. Science calls it observation, religion calls it awareness. Science calls it experiment, religion calls it experience. Science wants you to go into experiment without any prejudice in your mind, without any belief. You have to be open, available. You are not going to impose anything on reality. You are just going to be available to the reality, whatsoever it is. Even if it goes against all your ideas, you have to drop those ideas. But the reality cannot be denied. The scientific endeavor is risking your mind for reality, putting your mind aside for reality. Reality counts, not what you think about it. Your thinking may be right, may be wrong, but the reality will decide it. Your mind is not going to decide what is right and what is wrong. The same is the situation of an authentic religion, a scientific religion. If I am allowed, I would like to call science has two dimensions, the outer and the inner. The word religion can be dropped. You have two sciences, one objective science, another subjective science. And that's what is going to happen, whether you call it religion or science does not matter, names don't matter. But the methodology is exactly the same. You should not go in with a belief. No believer is ever going to know the truth. To believe is to miss. You have to put aside your ideology, however beautiful it looks, however systematic it looks, however philosophical you have made and decorated it. You have to put it aside and see within. That's the whole method of meditation, awareness, watchfulness. Meditation in short is putting your mind aside. So the people who say that meditation is a discipline of the mind are absolutely wrong. It is not a discipline of the mind. Because if you discipline the mind, it is going to become stronger. It is better to put it aside when it is weaker, undisciplined. Once it is disciplined, it is going to give you a tough fight. So it is more difficult for somebody who has been practicing concentration. Because concentration is a mind phenomenon. Yes, it gives you a better mind, disciplined mind, more penetrating. But to put aside this mind will be very difficult. First, you have given it strength. You have given it a certain crystallization. That's what happened to Gurdjieff and his holy school. It was a discipline of the mind. He called it crystallization. A very right word. The ordinary mind is a mess, a chaos. Gurdjieff's discipline gives you a crystallized mind. Together, centered. And he was thinking that the more your mind is crystallized, the more you are coming closer to home. There he was wrong. A crystallized mind starts having certain powers. For example, it can read somebody's thoughts, which the ordinary mind cannot do. It cannot read its own thoughts. How to read somebody else's thoughts? But the crystallized mind, but crystallization is not easy. It is a difficult and long process. Years of work, work which will look absolutely unnecessary to you. But you have to do it because the teacher says so. For example, Gurdjieff's disciples will be told to dig a trench 1 mile long. And all the disciples are digging the trench the whole day. And by the evening, Gurdjieff comes to look at it and he says, fill it up. Only then you will get food. I should not find it there when I come for my morning walk. No, absurd. This man is mad, you will think. He was not mad. He was working very accurately, mathematically. The disciples start filling the trench. The whole day they were digging. The whole day they were thinking why this is being dug. Now they are thinking why it is being filled again. And nobody knows, tomorrow morning he may say, dig it again. That man was known to do that. What he is trying is making you not the ordinary weak mind who needs all kinds of arguments, convictions to go into anything, then to it never goes. He is trying to teach you that you need not bother about why. That is the teacher's job to think. Your job is to do. And if a person goes on doing this way, year in, year out, he strangely finds in himself things happening which had never happened. For example, you are passing by his side and suddenly he reads your thought. Or it happened, one of my students, when I was teaching in the university, was very much interested in Gurdjieff. So he asked me that, I am not asking whether Gurdjieff is right or wrong. You just please explain to me what is the methodology that Gurdjieff was using and how I can use it. I said, if that is so, I can explain to you the method. But I am not responsible what happens to you then. He said, of course, you are not responsible. Because you are not giving me even chance to say whether it is right or wrong. You simply want to know, just as a professor, I am telling you this is the method. You practice it. The method is simple. Do anything, for example, jogging. There comes a moment when you feel you cannot jog anymore. Now that is the moment you have to jog. And suddenly you will be surprised that if you continue jogging, a new release of energy. And you were feeling that it was impossible to jog anymore. There are three layers of energy. One, the ordinary energy which you use in daily work, eating, walking, working, typing, this and that. Just the superficial layer. Underneath is a bigger layer of energy. If doing anything you come to the point that the thin layer, top layer is finished, that does not mean that energy is finished. Only top layer is finished. Then the top layer is saying, stop. Don't stop. Continue. Soon, the second layer is broken and becomes available. And you were thinking you cannot jog, and now you can jog for hours. Then again, a point comes when you feel that if now I go on doing, I am going to fall and die. It is not just tiredness, it is almost death. First it was tiredness, now it is almost like death. This is the third layer in you, which is vast. If you continue, you say, okay, if death comes, it is okay, but I am not going to stop. The third layer opens up, and you have never seen such energy in you. That sometimes accidentally happens to you. You are tired, the whole day's work and everything, and suddenly your house catches fire. And you were thinking just to jump in bed and forget the whole world, and the house is burning. You forget all about your tiredness. Suddenly you are fresh, young, so fresh, so young as you have never been. And you are running here and there and doing all kinds of things. Perhaps the whole night it will take put the fire out, and you will do it. And you will not feel tired. What has happened? The same thing Gurdjieff is trying to do methodologically. But once your mind becomes aware of these three layers, with each layer new powers are attached. With the ordinary layer, you cannot do much. Scientists say that even the most talented person uses only 15% of his energy. The most talented, it is not about everybody. And Albert Einstein perhaps uses 15% of his energy. The average ordinary person never goes above 7%. Einstein using 15% becomes aware of many things which you are not aware. He lives in a different universe than you live. His universe is so vast you cannot even imagine it. It was said that while he was alive, there were only 12 people in the whole world who understood exactly what theory of relativity means. Only 12 persons all over the world who understood exactly what he means. But if you know 30% of your energy, 50% of your energy, who knows what is in store? So this student of mine, he was a Mohammedan. And Mohammedans are fanatic people, very stubborn, trustworthy, but idiotic. Idiots are always trustworthy because they cannot doubt, they cannot suspect. So what I had told him to work upon, he started working. He was a woodcutter's son. So I said, you go with your father and cut wood as much as you can. And when you feel now you are going to fall, you cannot raise the axe again. That is the moment you have to raise it. Now is the right time to begin work. Up to now it was only superficial. From here Gurdjieff comes in. He did it. One day he came running to me, very much shaken and afraid. He said, what is happening? I was going in the bus and I just thought a strange thought. I have never thought such thoughts before. The man sitting in front of me, his back towards me, I just thought, can just by my thinking he can be managed to fall from his seat on the floor of the bus? And the man fell. He was just thinking this, that can it happen? It happened. He became very much frightened, but he thought it perhaps it may be a coincidence. So he tried on another man. And the other man fell. And the driver said, what is going on? One man falls for no reason at all, because there is no jerk, no turn. Then another man sitting just falls down, and he is not asleep, with open eyes. And he asked those two persons, they say, we don't know. But he thought, before he goes to me, he should try one time more. And better he tries on the driver. And he tried it on the driver. And he caused the whole accident of the bus, in which two persons died. Many got injured. Then he came running to me. He said, what is happening? Now, unknowingly, he has got that energy which can project ideas into somebody's head. And they will work. Now his mind is becoming crystallized, coming closer. It is only second layer. I told him, do you want to enter in the third layer? Because in the third layer you can cause the death of somebody. If you trust yourself, I can give you the method to go into the third, but then that power, are you capable of not misusing it? He said, no, I am not capable of misusing it, and forgive me. And I was wrong from the very beginning that I said to you that don't say to me whether Gurdjieff is right or wrong. Just give me the method, because I was reading the book and I was so much impressed. I don't want to go into it. This is dangerous. Concentration, discipline, yoga discipline, other methods of chanting, mantras, they all enforce your mind and make it stronger, capable of using the powers that are in your subconscious, in your unconscious, in your collective unconscious. And if you are not aware, and you are not aware, this is like giving a sword, naked sword, to a child to play with. Either he is going to hurt himself or kill somebody, something wrong is going to happen. You cannot conceive that anything good is going to happen out of it. The Brahmins in India have used the discipline of mind for thousands of years to keep the whole country and a slave to them. In India, in 5,000 years, no revolution happened. And there were all the possibilities for revolution to happen thousands of times in these years. 1/4 of India, the Brahmins have made untouchable. Those people cannot touch you. Not only the people cannot touch you, they are so dirty, they are suffering from their bad, evil karmas of past lives, that even their shadow falling on you is enough to disturb your existence. You have to take a bath immediately. Do you see the stupid idea? The shadow of a person passing over you has made you dirty. Shadow has no existence. Shadow cannot touch you. Shadow cannot carry any contamination. In India, for thousands of years, 1/4 of the country has lived in such a slavery that they will walk with a bell in their neck. So just like you put bell around the neck of a cow or a buffalo, so you know when the cow is coming, because the bell goes on ringing. So they had to keep a bell continuously ringing, so anybody hearing can escape away even from your shadow. And at the back, they had to attach a long brush like a tail. That was to go on cleaning the path on which they are traveling, because the shadow is falling there and the shadow has to be cleaned, because some Brahmin may be coming afterwards and walks on the earth where some untouchable, some achut, that is their word, has passed. Now, what power these Brahmins had? They were not kings. They had no armies. They had no temporal power of any kind. But they had a tremendous disciplined mind, which became more and more disciplined with every generation. Alexander the Great remembers in his memoirs, he came to India before Jesus Christ. And the things that impressed him the most . Of course, he came across thousands of things which impressed him. But this was the thing that impressed him most. He was the disciple of Aristotle. Socrates' disciple was Plato, Plato's disciple was Aristotle, Aristotle's disciple was Alexander the Great. When he was returning after invading India, he remembered that Aristotle had asked him that when you come back, you bring the four Vedas which Hindus think are the only God-written books. And of course, they are the ancient-most books in the world. So God-written or not, but they are the ancient-most treasure. You bring four Vedas with you. I don't want anything else. So he inquired that, can I find a person who has all the four Vedas? And people said, yes, in our village there is a great Brahmin scholar, ancient, very old, perhaps 200 years old, and he has all the four Vedas inherited. So no fear that there can be anything wrong in them. Thousands of years old. You can get it from him. Alexander went to the Brahmin, asked the old man. He had never seen such an old man. In fact, he had never seen such a man. The old man looked into his eyes and said, "Okay, tomorrow morning, as the sun rises, I will give you the four Vedas." Alexander was immensely happy. He said, "Whatsoever you want for me to do for you, you have done such a great favor to me. Because I was told that no Brahmin will give you the Vedas. Even if you give your whole empire, no Brahmin is going to give you the whole Vedas. And you have not asked anything." He said, "No. No Brahmin asks anything. Whatsoever he wants, he gets. Those who beg, they are not Brahmins. You come tomorrow morning and you will see." The whole night Alexander could not sleep. What is going to happen tomorrow morning? What kind of man he is? And what the old man did? He had four sons. He called all the four sons, sat around the home fire, which was kept alive for thousands of years, burning 24 hours, day in, day out, year in, year out. They all sat around that fire, and the father said, "You take each of you one Veda, read one page, drop it into the fire, read another page, drop it into the fire. Before the morning rises, you have to finish all the four Vedas." They did it, what the father said, and by the morning, when Alexander reached, and he reached a little early, he was so curious. What he saw, he could not understand what is happening. They were throwing the last pages. He said, "What is going on?" He said, "Nothing. You take these my four sons. These are the four Vedas. This is Rig Veda. This is Yajur Veda. This is Sam Veda. This is Athar Veda. Alexander said, "But I was asking about the books." He said, "They remember every word. That's what we have been doing the whole night." He asked how a person can remember the whole book in one night. The old Brahmin said, "You don't know Brahmins. This is our discipline. Our whole discipline is to sharpen memory to such a stage that once you have read anything, there is no way to forget it." This story came into the hands of another great king, Akbar, a Mohammedan. he could not believe, because Vedas are big, voluminous collections. He inquired in his court that find out anybody who can repeat this incident in front of me. And one man stood up and he said, this is nothing. I know a Brahmin in my village who can do 1,000 times more. This is nothing. The man was called to the court of the great Akbar. And in his court, there were scholars of Sanskrit, Arabic, Persian, Prakrit, Pali, of other ancient languages, because he was very scholarly himself and he wanted the topmost scholars to be around him. There were 30 people who knew 30 different languages, and this was the arrangement that was done, that this man who was brought from the village, who looked like a villager, a simple Brahmin, this was the arrangement that everybody should keep in his mind one sentence in his language. So there will be 30 sentences in 30 languages. And this man knows only one language, Sanskrit. So in those 30 languages, Sanskrit was not included. This man will go to the first man. The first man will say the first word of his sentence. And there will be struck a gong. Then he will go to the second man, he will say his first word, and this will again a gong. He will go to 30 people again and again, second round, second word, a gong. Third round, until all the sentences are complete. And then he will repeat all the 30 sentences. And he did it. Must have been a great computer. But if computers can do, why not mind? If mind can create computers, and I have not heard about any computer yet creating a mind. The mind has much more power. You can discipline it in many ways, and the pseudo-religions have developed methods of concentration. Remember, concentration is not meditation, because concentration is a discipline of the mind, and meditation is putting the mind aside. In fact, the English word meditation is not the right word, because in the West, nothing like meditation has ever happened. The Sanskrit word is dhyana. The same was the problem when Buddhist monks went to China. They could not find a right word to translate dhyana into Chinese. So they wrote dhyana, which to Chinese sounded like zhana. Hence the Japanese zen. It is a transfiguration of the word dhyana. Meditation gives again a wrong idea, as if you are meditating upon something, as if it is an activity. It is not much different from concentration. You are concentrating on something, you are contemplating on something, you are meditating on something, but you are always concerned with something. And what dhyana is, dropping all objects, dropping anything on which you can concentrate, contemplate, meditate, dropping everything. Nothing is left, only the one who was concentrating. Only the one who was contemplating. That pure awareness is dhyana. In English, there is no right word, so you have to understand that we are using meditation for dhyana. Dhyana means a state of being where there is no thought, no object, no dream, no desire, nothing. Just emptiness. In that emptiness, you come to know yourself. You discover the truth. You discover your subjectivity. It is perfect science. And there are methods how to put aside the mind. Just as there are methods how to discipline the mind. But in the West, and in America more so, because if the West is bad, America is worse. I have been looking at American books. Not now. For 4 years I have not touched a book. All the books that are best sellers in America are somehow concerned how to increase your willpower, how to influence people and win friends. How to grow rich. Mind over matter. But they are all talking about the discipline of the mind. And certainly, if you discipline the mind, you are a better competitor. You can fulfill your ambition more easily. You can manipulate people more easily. You can exploit people more easily. You can use others as means to your end. Friedrich Nietzsche has written a book, Will to Power. That is the very essence of the whole Western effort, will to power. Will to power needs, first, you should have a willpower. And willpower is another name for your mind, disciplined, crystallized. No, these methods won't do. You have to learn methods how to put the mind aside. It is already too much powerful. Don't make it more powerful, because you are feeding your own enemy. It is already crystallized. Your school, your college, your university, they are all doing that. After remaining 9 years a professor in a university, I resigned. I said to the vice chancellor that I cannot do this work because this is destroying people. He said, what do you mean that this means destroying people? Students love you. They won't allow you to leave. And I don't see on what grounds you are saying that you cannot continue to destroy people. I said, you will not understand. Because although you are born in India, you don't know India. You have been educated in the West. He has remained his whole life in the West. All these books, all these psychologies that I have to teach, I am teaching against myself. I know these are going to do harm to these people. Their minds are already in a bad shape. And now they will become stronger. Their chains will be far more stronger. Their slavery of the mind will be far more stronger. The pseudo-religion depends on disciplining the mind. The real religion's first work is to put the mind aside. And it is in a way very simple. Those disciplines are very difficult. To train the mind for concentration is very difficult, because it goes on revolting. It goes on falling back into its old habits. You pull it again and it escapes. You bring it again to the subject you were concentrating, and suddenly you find you are thinking something else. You have forgotten what you were concentrating upon. It is not an easy job. But to put it aside is a very simple thing, not difficult at all. All that you have to do is to watch. Whatsoever is going in your mind, don't interfere. Don't try to stop. Do not do anything, because whatsoever you do will become a discipline. So do not do anything at all. Just watch. Watching is not a doing. Just as you watch the sunset, or the clouds in the sky, or people passing on the street, watch the traffic of thoughts and dreams, nightmares, relevant, irrelevant, consistent, inconsistent, anything is going on, and it is always rush hour. You simply watch, you stand by the side, unconcerned. The pseudo-religions don't allow to remain unconcerned, because they say greed is bad. So if a thought of greed comes, you jump to prevent it, otherwise you will become greedy. Anger is bad. If an angry thought passes by, you immediately jump, you have to change it, you have to be kind and compassionate, and you have to love your enemy just like yourself. If something against your neighbor comes, no. You have to love your neighbor just like yourself. So, all the old religions have given you ideas, what is right, what is wrong. And if the wrong thing is passing by, certainly you have to stop. You have to interfere, you have to jump in. Pull that thing out. You miss the point. That's why I don't say to you what is right and what is wrong. All that I say is, to watch is right, not to watch is wrong. I make it absolutely simplified. Be watchful. It is none of your business if greed is passing by. Let it pass. If anger is passing by, let it pass. Who are you to interfere? Why you are so much identified with your mind? Why you start thinking, I am greedy, I am angry? There is only a thought of anger passing by. Let it pass. You just watch. There is an ancient story. A man who has gone out of his town comes back and finds that his house is on fire. And it was one of the most beautiful houses in the town. And the man loved the house. And many people were ready to give double price of the house, but he had never agreed for any price. And now it is just burning before his eyes. And thousands of people have gathered, but nothing can be done. The fire has spread so far that even if you try to put it out, nothing will be saved. So he becomes very sad. His son comes running and whispers something into his ear that, don't be worried, I had sold it yesterday. And at a very good price, 3 times. The offer was so good, I could not wait for you, forgive me. But the father said, Good. If you have sold for 3 times more than the price of the house, then the father is also a watcher with other watchers. Just a moment before, he was not a watcher. He was identified. It is the same house, the same fire. Everything is same. But now he is not concerned. He is enjoying just as everybody else is enjoying. Then the second son comes running and he said to the father, what are you doing? You are smiling and the house is on fire. The father said, don't you know your brother has sold it? He said, he had talked about selling it, but nothing has been settled yet. And the man is not going to purchase now. Again, everything changing. Tears, which has disappeared, has come back to his eyes. A smile is no more there. Heart is beating fast. But the watcher is gone. He is again identified. And then the third son comes and he says, that man is a man of word. I am coming just from him. He said, it doesn't matter whether the house is burnt or not. It is mine. And I am going to pay the price that I have settled for. Neither you knew it, nor I knew it, that the house will get fire. Again, he is a watcher. The identity is no more there. Actually, nothing is changing. Just the idea that I am the owner, that I am identified somehow with the house, makes the whole difference. The moment he feels I am not identified, somebody else has purchased it, I have nothing to do. Let the house burn. This simple methodology of watching the mind, that you have nothing to do with it. Most of its thoughts are not yours. Your parents, your teachers, your friends, the books, the movies, the television, the newspapers. Just count how many thoughts are your own, and you will be surprised that not a single thought is your own. All are from other sources, all are borrowed, either dumped by others on you or foolishly dumped by yourself upon yourself. But nothing is yours. The mind is there, functioning like a computer. Exactly, it is a biocomputer. You will not get identified with the computer. If the computer gets hot, you won't get hot. If the computer gets angry and starts giving signals in 4-letter words, you will not be worried. You will see what is wrong, where is something is wrong. But you remain detached. Just a small neck. I cannot even call it a method, because that makes it heavy. I call it a neck. Just by doing it, one day suddenly you are able to do it. Many times you will fail, nothing to be worried. No loss, natural. But just doing it one day, it happens. Once it has happened, once you have for a single moment even become the watcher, you know now how to become the watcher. The watcher on the hills, far away. And the whole mind is there, deep down in the dark valley. And you are not to do anything about it. The most strange thing about mind is that if you become a watcher, it starts disappearing. Just like the light disperses darkness, watchfulness disperses mind, its thoughts, its whole paraphernalia. So meditation is simply watchfulness, awareness. And that reveals it is nothing to do with inventing. It invents nothing. It simply discovers that which is there. And what is there? You enter and you find infinite emptiness. So tremendous. Beautiful, so silent, so full of light, so fragrant, that you have entered into the kingdom of God. In my words, you have entered into godliness. And once you have been in this space, you come out and you are a totally new person, a new man. Now you have your original face, all masks have disappeared. You will live in the same world, but not in the same way. You will be in the same people, but not with the same attitude and the same approach. You will live like a lotus in water, in the water, but absolutely untouched by water. Religion is the discovery of this lotus flower within.
The word content and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.